Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is the Welsh national hero, Owain Glyndwr. And my co-host for the presentation is, of course, Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we move on to our Greatest Britons for this week then, Max?
Yes, that's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Let's start with a new Greatest Briton. Our Greatest Briton for this week is Owain Glyndwr, the Welsh hero. Owain Glyndwr, commonly known as Owen Glyndwr or Glyndwr, anglicised as Owen Glendower, was a Welsh leader who led a long-running war of independence with the aim of ending English rule in Wales during the late Middle Ages. He formed the first Welsh Parliament and he was the last native-born Welshman to hold the title the Prince of Wales. And that was a title that was given to him by the Welsh. I don't think that was acknowledged by the English monarchy. Owain Glyndwr was a descendant of the Princes of Powys through his father, Gruffydd Fechan II, hereditary Tuasog of Powys, Fadog, and Lord of Glyndyfrdwy. Through his mother, Ellen Firk Thomas ap Llywelyn, he was a descendant of the Princes of Deheubarth, and that's Pembrokeshire. And through her, Glyndwr was also a descendant of Llywelyn the Great of the Gwynedd Royal House of Aberfraw. On 16th of September 1400, Owain Glyndwr instigated a 15-year Welsh revolt against the rule of King Henry IV of England. With the use of guerrilla tactics, the Welsh troops managed to inflict a series of defeats on the English forces and captured key castles across Wales, rapidly gaining control of most of the country. News of the rebellion's success spread internationally across Europe, and Glyndwr began to receive naval support from Scotland and Brittany. He also received the support of King Charles VI of France, who agreed to send French troops and supplies to aid the rebellion. In 1403, a Welsh army, including a French contingent, assimilated into forces mainly from Morgannwg and the Rhondda Valleys region, commanded by Owain Glyndwr, his senior general, Rhys Gethin, and Cadogan, Lord of Glen Rhondda, defeated a large English invasion force, reputedly led by King Henry IV himself, at the Battle of Stalling Down in Glamorgan, South Wales. By 1404, no less than four royal military expeditions into Wales had been repelled, and Owain solidified his control of the nation. He was officially crowned the Prince of Wales and held a parliament at Machynlleth, where he outlined his national programme for an independent Wales, which included plans such as building two national universities, one in the south and one in the north, and I think that has now been done, reintroducing the traditional Welsh laws of Hywel Da, and those are the laws that actually went back to before Saxon times, and establishing an independent Welsh church, which again is very interesting because that goes back to before Saxon times. This is before the Reformation, before the Church of England. There were envoys from other countries, including from France, Scotland, and the Kingdom of Leon in Spain. In the summer of 1405, four representatives from every cumhwt in Wales were sent to Harlech, and in the same year, he signed the Tripartite Indenture. So everything was all going really well for the independence of Wales. But later that year, in September, King Henry IV led a large English army of 40,000 men, including heavy artillery, into Wales. Severely outnumbered, Glyndwr decided to avoid a pitched battle and instead resorted to guerrilla warfare. Similar to the early years of the war, he organised the Welsh army into many small units of lightly equipped and highly mobile warbands, which gave them the ability to outmanoeuvre, surround and constantly harass the English by carrying out ambushes, sabotage, raids and surprise hit-and-run attacks from multiple different locations. The Welsh also raided the English supply lines and successfully captured 40 supply wagons carrying food and water. King Henry's army quickly became demoralised and were forced to retreat back to England, marking yet another impressive victory for Glyndwr. Despite the initial success of the revolution, however, in 1407, the superior numbers, resources and wealth that England had at its disposal eventually began to turn the tide of the war, and the much larger and better equipped English forces gradually began to overwhelm the Welsh. and by 1409 they had reconquered most of Wales. Glyndwr fought on until he was cornered and under siege at Harlech Castle, but he managed to escape capture by disguising himself as an elderly man, sneaking out of the castle and slipping past the English military blockade in the darkness of the night. Owain retreated to the Welsh wilderness with a band of loyal supporters, where he refused to surrender and continued the war with guerrilla tactics, such as by launching sporadic raids and ambushes throughout Wales and the English borderlands. The last documented sighting of him was in 1412, when he ambushed the king's men in Brecon and captured and ransomed a leading supporter of King Henry's. He twice ignored offers of a pardon from the new king, Henry V of England, and despite the large rewards offered for his capture, Glyndwr was never betrayed to the English. His death was recorded by a former follower in the year 1415 at the age of approximately 56. With his death, Owain acquired a mythical status along with Cadwalader and Arthur as a folk hero awaiting the call to return and liberate his people, Imab Darogan, or the foretold son. And Glyndwr is spelt in the work as Owen Glyndwr, appears as a king in William Shakespeare's play Henry IV, Part 1. And I think this really shows that he must have had support from the English, because William Shakespeare actually portrayed him as a king in the play that he made of Henry IV. And we can see that he had support from the Scots, he had support from Brittany, he had support from France, he had support from the continent. And this was a very credible push for independence by the Welsh. And he is really held up today as a great hero of the Welsh people. And he's included in the Greatest Britons, obviously, because the Welsh were the original Britons. He's fairly high up in the BBC's top 100 Greatest Britons as well. And he's a nationalist hero, because that was what he was trying to do. He was trying to gain independence for the ethnic nation of the Welsh. And Max, do you want to pick up on any of those points?
Well, I don't know a lot about Owen Glyndwr. I know there's a statue to him in Llanberis, which I've driven past on many occasions on my various visits to the north of Wales. For him to have persisted in resisting English rule over Wales for so long that he died at the age of 56, that's quite remarkable, really. In view of the fact that the average life expectancy, I would have imagined, for most men in those times would have perhaps even been less than 50, would have perhaps been 45 or something like that because of disease or whatever. You know, for him, leading a life of effectively warfare most of the time, that is doubly remarkable then, that he lived for what probably was a decade beyond the average life expectancy for men of his time.
Yeah, and he managed to unite the Welsh and get them to all fight on his side as well. And it had been about 200 years since King Edward I had actually taken the crown from the Welsh and placed it on his son's head, which is why you have the Prince of Wales today is always the eldest son of the English monarch. Yet Glyndwr could trace his royalty back to the earlier royalty of the country, that could trace their royalty back to Brutus, again, who we've talked about in an earlier episode of The Greatest Britons. And that was Glyndwr's right to rule. And that's why he was crowned by the Welsh people. And that was why people flocked to his standard, basically. Well, let's start with a look at his early life. Glyndwr was born around 1359 to a prosperous landed family, part of the Anglo-Welsh gentry of the Northern Welsh Marches, which is the border between England and Wales. This group moved easily between Welsh and English societies and languages, occupying important offices for the Marcher Lords while maintaining their position as Ulchilwyr, nobles descended from the pre-conquest Welsh royal dynasties in traditional Welsh society. And the Marcher Lords were the people that controlled the borders, basically. And because he was descended from the nobles, he would, and those people that were descended from the nobles that went back to royalty before Saxon and Norman times, they were the ones that held this high position in society, working with these Marcher Lords, who were mainly of Norman extraction. His father, Gruffydd Fechan II, hereditary Tuasog of Powys Fadog and Lord of Glendyffrydwy, died sometime before 1370, leaving Glendyr's mother, Ellen Firth Thomas of Llewellyn of Dyhubarth, a widow, and Owain, a young man of 16 years at the most. So he lost his father at a young age. The young Owain ap Gruffydd was possibly fostered at the home of David Hanmer, a rising lawyer, shortly to be a justice of the King's Bench, or at the home of Richard Fitzalan, the third Earl of Arundel. So he's obviously having a lot to do with the English there, with the Earl of Arundel, and also a lawyer that worked for the King's Bench. Owain is then thought to have been sent to London to study law at the Inns of Court. He probably studied as a legal apprentice in London for a period of 7 years, and he was possibly in London during the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. By 1384, he was living in Wales and married to Margaret Hanmer, although they may have married at an earlier date in the late 1370s, according to sources. They started a large family, and Owain established himself as the squire of Sycharth and Glendyffrydwy. Glendyr entered the English king's military service in 1384 when he undertook garrison duty under the renowned Welshman Sir Gregory Sias, or Sir Degary Sias, on the English-Scottish border at Berwick-upon-Tweed. His surname Sias, meaning Englishman in Welsh, refers to his ability to speak English, which was not common in Wales at the time. In August 1385, he served King Richard II under the command of John of Gaunt, again in Scotland. In 1386, he was called to give evidence at the High Court of Chivalry, the Scrope v. Grosvenor trial at Chester on the 3rd of September that year. And the High Court of Chivalry dealt with issues of heraldry. Apparently it's still there, but it doesn't actually get used for very much now. In March 1387, Owain was in southeast England as a squire to Richard Fitzalan, the fourth Earl of Arundel, in the English Channel at the defeat of a Franco-Spanish-Flemish fleet off the coast of Kent. So he's seen a fair bit of live action actually defending the English. Upon the death in late 1387 of his father-in-law, Sir David Hanmer, knighted earlier that same year by Richard II, Glendyr returned to Wales as executor of his estate. Glendyr served as a squire to Henry Bolingbroke, later Henry IV of England, son of John of Gaunt, at the short, sharp Battle of Radcot Bridge in December 1387. So he actually served as squire to Henry IV, who was his opponent later on when they started the revolution. From the year 1384 until 1388, he had been active in military service and had gained 3 full years of military experience in different theatres and had seen at first hand some key events and noteworthy people. King Richard was distracted by a growing conflict with the Lords Appellant from this time onwards. Glendyr's opportunities were further limited by the death of Sir Gregory Sias in 1390 and the sidelining of Richard Fitzalan, the Earl of Arundel, and he probably returned to his stable Welsh estates, living there quietly for 10 years during his 40s. The bard Iolo Gosh, or Red Iolo, himself a Welsh lord, visited Glendyr in Sycharth in the 1390s and wrote a number of odes to Owain, praising Owain's liberality and the writing of Sycharth. Rare was it there to see a latch or a lock, is what he said. And there are still parts of Great Britain today where people don't lock their doors. But what he was saying here is that they didn't even have latches or locks on their houses. They had such a community of trust there. So he's seen a lot of military activity, and he's now, what does it say here, in his 40s. So when he actually led the Welsh, I mean, he was getting on there, Max. As you were pointing out, to die at a late age like that, he must have been very healthy at the time. Got any comments you want to make on his early life?
Yeah, it's also fairly clear that he was somebody of note within English society as well as Welsh society. You know, he had. Friends and sponsors, people that he worked with, people that he worked for, that were senior people, people of substance within British society generally, not just in Wales. So he wasn't somebody who was a nobody who just decided to launch a revolution for spurious reasons. He was somebody who had been a to some extent a what's the word I'm thinking of here an action rage. He was somebody who was active within English society and was had been given responsibility and higher responsibility than lots of people would have had during their lives during his early life.
Yeah, he'd shown loyalty to the king. He'd shown loyalty to England. He'd fought for them. And I think, you know, the uprising or the revolution, I mean, it did stand some chance of success. I mean, it wasn't 200 years since the crown had been taken by England. 150 years is just the length of time. So I think he did think that there could have been some measure of success with this. In the late 1390s, a series of events began to push Owain towards rebellion in what was later to be called the Welsh Revolt, or the Glyndwr Rising, or within Wales, the Last War of Independence. His neighbour, Baron Gray de Ruthyn, had seized control of some land, for which Glyndwr appealed to the English Parliament. Owain's petition for redress was ignored. Later in 1400, Lord Grey informed Glyndwr too late of a royal command to levy feudal troops for Scottish border service, thus enabling him to call the Welshman a traitor in London court circles. Lord Grey had stature in the royal court of King Henry IV, and the English courts refused to hear, or the case was delayed because of Lord Grey, preventing Owain's letter from reaching the king. So we see that this neighbour, who was one of these marcher lords, he stole some of Glyndwr's land there, and when he was supposed to tell Glyndwr that he needed to get his men together to support the English king, he didn't tell him, and then he was denouncing him as a traitor. However, an alternative source states that Glyndwr was under threat because he had written an angry letter to Lord Grey, boasting that lands had come into his possession and he had stolen some of Lord Grey's horses. And believing Lord Grey had threatened to burn and slay within his lands, he threatened retaliation in the same manner. I think I believe the first one more than this second one. Lord Grey then denied making the initial threat to burn and slay, and replied that he would take the incriminating letter to Henry IV's council, and that Glyndwr would hang for the admission of theft and treason contained within the letter. The deposed king, Richard II, had support in Wales, and in January 1400, serious civil disorder broke out in the English border city of Chester after the public execution of an officer of Richard II. So it seems like we had two kings there at the time, two English kings. One of them had been deposed in favour of Henry IV, and there was support for Richard II in Wales. These events led to Glyndwr formally assuming his ancestral title of the Prince of Powys on the 16th of September 1400 at his Glenfrothwy estate. With a small band of followers, which included his eldest son, his brothers-in-law, and the Bishop of St. Asaph in the town of Corwin, possibly in the church of Esses Mael and Sulium, he launched an assault on Lord Grey's territories. After a number of initial confrontations between King Henry IV and Owain's followers in September and October 1400, the revolt, which is a prequel to the War of the Roses, began to spread. Much of northern and central Wales went over to Glyndwr. Henry IV appointed Henry Percy, the famous Hotspur, to bring the country to order. The King and the English Parliament on 10th of March 1401 issued an amnesty which applied to all rebels, with the exception of Owain and his cousins, Rhys of Tudor and Gwilym of Tudor, the sons of Tudor ap Gronwy, the forefather of King Henry VI of England. Both the Tudors were pardoned after their capture of Edward I's great castle at Conwy on the 28th of May 1401. In June, Glyndwr scored his first major victory in the field of Menyth Hedyn on Plumlimmon. Retaliation by Henry IV on the Strata Florida Abbey followed in October. The rebel uprising had occupied all of North Wales. Labourers seized whatever weapons they could. Farmers sold their cattle to buy arms. Secret meetings were held everywhere, and the bards wandered about as messengers of sedition. Castles fell into Glendur's hands as he assumed the Prince of Wales title. Henry IV of England heard of a Welsh uprising at Leicester. Henry's army then wandered North Wales to Anglesey and drove out the Franciscan friars who favoured Richard II. All the while, Glendur, who was in hiding, had his estate forfeited to John Beaufort, the first Earl of Somerset. Glendur had been offered a pardon on the 10th of March, 1401, but he rejected the plea. On the 30th of May, Hotspur, having won a battle near Cader Idris, left his command for the English army and began dealings with Glendur. During this time, in spring 1401, Glendur appears in South Wales, and by autumn the counties Gwynedd, Ceredigion, which temporarily submitted to England for a pardon, and Powys adhered to the rising against the English rule. Glendur's attempts at stoking rebellion with help from the Scottish and the Irish were quashed, with the English showing no mercy and hanging some messengers. So he wasn't able to get Scottish and Irish support here. But we can see that his ancestry and his cousins go back to the Tudors as well. And when the Tudor kings actually came in onto the throne of England, their ancestry did go back to Brutus, and they went back to the Welsh ancestry. So it was actually seen by the Welsh that they actually had their own kings on the throne again with the Tudors. And as it says here, this is a precursor to the Wars of the Roses. Do you know anything about the Wars of the Roses, Max? Do you know anything about this period in history?
Not a tremendous amount. What I would say is that from listening to what you've been saying about Owen Glendur, the theme to be lots of rivalries between various families that have got noble heritage, basically. And so the staging of a rebellion by Owen Glendur against English rule isn't so much an act of politics on his or sort of ideology on his part, more an act of rivalry where he felt that he would make a better king than the King of England, and so therefore and because of his familial attachment to Wales, used Wales as the instrument of his rebellion and rivalry against the King of England at the time. And so I think that the danger of looking too deeply and regarding these kind of things as being of too great a significance is that you run the risk of reopening old wounds, effectively. And I think that we have to be careful in this situation in terms of viewing somebody like Owen Glendur and to make sure that we that our perception of him is as somebody who is demonstrating leadership ability and rather than somebody who is demonstrating some kind of ideological position which is better than that was presented by the King of England, effectively.
Yeah, I don't think it was so much ideology. It was his ancestral right, and I think he would have been loyal to the King of England if they had acknowledged him as being the Prince of Wales. I don't think there was any idea of his to go to war against the English. They just wanted independence for Wales. They wanted to have their own universities, and they wanted to follow the laws that they had always followed, which were, by that time, they were called the laws of Hwelda. But they actually went back to before Alfred the Great, and going all the way back to the Brutus line, the Molmutine laws. That was the original guy that created these laws, and that was all that they wanted to do. And you know, he had standing in England, and he had served the king, and he had served militarily, and he understood the legal side of things. So he was basically just trying to exercise the right of Wales to actually be independent, because they'd had enough of bad treatment from these Marcher lords. And I mean, you had that Marcher lord there that was playing dirty tricks on him. He would have found the men to go and fight in Scotland for the King of England, but the Marcher Lord didn't actually give him the letter. So that shows you that he did have this this loyalty. It's not like he would have tried to take over England and take over the whole country or anything like that. He just wanted Wales.
What I'm saying, though, is that those kind of dirty tricks probably were the sort of things that were practiced between families of noble heritage and that were descendants from kings of old all over the British Isles. So you probably would have had noble people from Norfolk. They would have felt rivalry with noble people from Suffolk, and people from Norfolk would have had rivalry with people from East Midlands or something of that sort. And so and they would have played the same kind of tricks on each other as they jostled for influence and as they jostled for in the hope of claiming the throne of England, as well as holding a dominant position in their regional part of the British Isles.
Oh, definitely. There were all sorts of dirty tricks that were played against one another. And one of the impressive things is that the Welsh were all offered pardons if they would stop supporting him, but they didn't stop supporting him. You know, they wanted to be independent and they wanted to follow their own prince. Well, in 1402, the English Parliament issued the penal laws against Wales, designed to establish English dominance in Wales, but these actually pushed many Welshmen into the rebellion. In the same year, Glyndwr captured his arch-enemy, Baron Grey de Ruthyn. He held him for almost a year until he received a substantial ransom from Henry. In June 1402, Glyndwr defeated an English force led by Sir Edmund Mortimer near Pileth, which is the Battle of Bronglas, where Mortimer was captured. Glyndwr offered to release Mortimer for a large ransom, but in sharp contrast to his attitude to de Grey, Henry IV refused to pay. Mortimer's nephew could be said to have had a greater claim to the English throne than Henry himself, so his speedy release was not an option. In response, Mortimer negotiated an alliance with Glyndwr and married one of Glyndwr's daughters. It is also in 1402 that mention of the French and Bretons helping Owain was first heard. The French were certainly hoping to use Wales, as they had used Scotland, as a base from which to fight the English. Glyndwr, facing years on the run, finally lost his estate in the spring of 1403, when Prince Henry, as usual, marched into Wales unopposed and burnt down his houses at Sycharth and Glendyfrdwy, as well as the Comote of Iderneon and parts of Powys. Glyndwr continued to besiege towns and burn down castles in response. For 10 days in July that year, he toured south and southeast Wales until all of the south joined arms in rebelling against English rule. These actions induced an internal rebellion to the King of England, with the Percies joining the rising. It is around this stage of Glyndwr's life that Hywel Sul, a cousin of the Welsh prince, attempted to assassinate Glyndwr at the Nanow estate. So we see that a lot of the English are taking part in this as well. Relatives of this royalty that also had a claim on the throne. So it wasn't just the Welsh that were involved here. In 1403, the revolt became truly national in Wales. Royal officials reported that Welsh students at Oxford University and Cambridge University were leaving their studies to join Glyndwr, and also that Welsh labourers and craftsmen were abandoning their employers in England and returning to Wales. Owain could also draw on Welsh troops seasoned by the English campaigns in France and Scotland, and hundreds of Welsh archers and experienced men-at-arms left the English service to join the rebellion. In 1404, Glyndwr's forces took Aberystwyth Castle and Harlech Castle, then continued to ravage the south by burning Cardiff Castle. And then a court was held at Harlech, and Gruffydd Young was appointed as the Welsh Chancellor. There had been communications to Louis I, the Duke of Orleans in Paris, to try and gain a treaty, but they failed in opening the Welsh ports to French trade. So they've even got so far as trying to sort out trade agreements with these other countries as well. And you've now got all the Welsh in England that are joining the cause, as well as the supporters of people that had a different claim on who was supposed to be the king at the time. Max, any thoughts on that?
Well, just that it's remarkable actually how similar how similar what was taking place in England or Britain at the time mirrors similar developments today in between Russia and Ukraine.
And what were they using? Were they using a proxy?
Well, not necessarily using. Where external powers are using a proxy, but where, for example, Ukraine has succeeded in having good relations with other countries and incorporating help from them in securing their independence from Russia, and where Russia effectively is kind of like playing the position that England played relative to Wales, and with various alliances coming into play and various people giving help to either one side or the other.
Yeah, there's a lot of historical precedents here that are similar to what's going on over there. Also, you had the Welsh were prevented from speaking their own language, and also in Ukraine, they prevented the Russians from speaking their own language. So there are all sorts of historical precedents that took place between England and Wales that we do see happening right now with Ukraine and Russia. And these points here that the French were seeking to get a treaty with the Welsh so that they could then use the Welsh as a form of attacking the English, which again is, well, I would say, suggest is similar to America working with Ukraine and then using the Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia and to go against Russia. So you see, all these things have historical precedents, and it helps to understand them so we can see what's going on today. Shall we talk about our greatest Britons, Max? Shall we move on to earlier times in our history?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's talk about our greatest Briton for the week, which is Owain Glyndwr again. We'll start with a recap. Owain was from a noble family with a claim to the Welsh throne. He studied law at the Inns of Court, and he served under the English King Richard II in military service in Scotland. Owain fell out with his neighbour, Baron Grey de Ruthyn, who neglected to tell Owain that his troops were needed for military service, so that he could then denounce him as a traitor to the new king, Henry IV. The deposed King Richard II had support in Wales, and civil disorder broke out in Chester when one of his men was hanged. It was after this that Owain assumed his ancestral title of Prince of Wales and started leading assaults on Grey's lands at first, and later he led his supporters into direct conflict with Henry IV. Much of North and Central Wales flocked to Owain's banner, and Henry IV enacted the Wales penal laws, which were designed to bring the Welsh to heel. But all they did was enrage the Welsh throughout England and Wales, and by 1403, students were leaving Oxford and Cambridge universities to return to Wales to fight for Welsh independence. By this time, many of the castles had been taken by the Welsh insurgents, but they failed to open the ports to French trade, although they did try to gain a treaty with Louis I in Paris. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max? Bring up anything else from last episode?
I'm quite happy with the resume you've given there. I've not got anything that has occurred to me so far.
I do think you made a good point in the last episode about how this wasn't to do with ideology. This was to do with how this was Owain Glyndwr's ancestry. And actually, at this time, there was a lot of different families that sort of had a claim to the throne. We ended up with the Wars of the Roses. We ended up with the Tudors, and we ended up with some of these supporters that supported the English king that were supporting Owain Glyndwr. So it hadn't actually been settled who should actually be the king of England and who should actually be the king of Wales, basically, at the time. So you had all these different families, noble families, that were sort of fighting amongst one another to actually gain that recognition. Although I do think that Owain did have some good ideas about actually governing Wales as well, so that just sort of sets the scene, and we'll continue.
I think you're absolutely right there. The most striking thing about his existence and the life that he led, etc., was the fact that he was one of many men, as you've just described, who were potential monarchs for Britain. And instead of the situation that we have today, where you look around the establishment, you look around Parliament, you look around the country, and there are very few people that in the public eye who have the sort of qualities that one would expect of a monarch. And so we are pretty much, you know, we don't have much of a choice. We're starved of any sort of choice. And the sort of people who are potential monarchs within our country are fairly dismal people in terms of their sort of the vigor that they provide for the nation, and in terms of protecting the people against abuses by government. And yet what we had in the days of Owen Glyndwr, the 15th century, we had a surfeit, really, of men like him who were the representatives of noble families, any one of which could have risen to the fore and been a superb monarch and would have had all of the instincts that one would expect of somebody who is the king of a country. And so there's a marked contrast between the situation that existed then and the situation that exists now.
Yeah, the line of inheritance for the monarchy is all settled now. And I guess it wasn't settled back then. I mean, we even had King William of Orange came over and was our king. And there were times before that, there was kings from Brittany and Armorica that came over and were kings of Wales. And, of course, William the Norman when he came over. So it was a time when it wasn't settled. And as you say, Max, we had these heroic men of noble stock that were all jostling for recognition. Well, a Senedd, which is the Welsh word for the Parliament, was held in Machynlleth in 1404, where Glyndwr was crowned Prince of Wales in the presence of emissaries from Scotland, France and Spain. Machynlleth may have been chosen due to its central location in Wales and the recently acquired possession of three nearby castles, Castle Eber, Aberystwyth Castle and Harlech Castle. And Aberystwyth Castle was originally... I'm thinking of Carnarvon. Carnarvon was the main one that Edward I built, but they're still fairly big castles that have fallen into the Welsh hands here. The Parliament House in Machynlleth is associated with the 1404 Senedd, but the present building is more recent. Local tradition is that the stones used came from the original 1404 building. And I've actually been to this original Parliament House in Machynlleth. It's a great shame that they don't have more to do with Owain Glyndwr there. There's just a small glass box with some paperwork inside it, and that's it. Wales really should have a proper museum that's dedicated to him. Well, in February 1405, Glyndwr negotiated the tripartite indenture with Edmund Mortimer and Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland. And the indenture agreed to divide England and Wales among the three of them. Wales would extend as far as the rivers Severn and Mersey, including most of Cheshire, Shropshire and Herefordshire. And the Mortimer Lords of March would take all of the southern and western England, and the Percys would take the north of England. So we can see here that it was up for grabs, basically. Whoever was entitled or whoever came from a noble family and thought that they could be king, there was a possibility that they could have done. Although negotiations with the Lords of Ireland were unsuccessful, Glyndwr had reason to hope that the French and the Bretons might be more welcoming. He dispatched Gruffydd Yong and his brother-in-law, John Hanmer, to negotiate with the French. And the result was a formal treaty that promised French aid to Glyndwr and the Welsh. The immediate effect seems to have been that joint Welsh and Franco-Breton forces attacked and laid siege to Kidwelly Castle. And they say Breton here, and obviously Brittany was originally a part of the British lands anyway. It was the British monarchy that owned Brittany. That's why it was called Brittany, although it's now a part of France. Scots and French privateers were operating around Wales throughout Owain's War. Scottish ships had raided English settlements on the Llyn Peninsula in 1400 and 1401. And in 1403, a Breton squadron defeated the English in the Channel and devastated Jersey, Guernsey and Plymouth, while the French made a landing on the Isle of Wight. By 1404, they were raiding the coast of England with Welsh troops on board, setting fire to Dartmouth and devastating the coast of Devon. So, I mean, this you had lots of people from the continent that were actually taking part in this. And of course, we talked about the privateers before, these sort of legalised pirates. 1405 was the year of the French in Wales. A formal treaty between Wales and France was negotiated. On the continent, the French pressed the English as the French army invaded English Plantagenet Aquitaine. Simultaneously, the French landed in force at Milford Haven in West Wales and eventually took Pembroke Castle. The combined forces of the French and the Welsh marched through Herefordshire and on into Worcestershire to Woodbury Hill, and there they met the English army just 10 miles from Worcester. The armies took up battle positions daily and viewed each other from a mile without any major action for 8 days. Then, for reasons that have never become clear, the Welsh retreated, and so did the French shortly afterwards. Very strange. Nobody knows why that actually happened. Max, any thoughts on any of that?
It's clear that Owen Glendower had the support of a lot of foreign interests who all had something to gain by the fall of England, really, and the disunity that the alliance that he had made would bring about.
And you also think, I mean, what is this, 1066, sort of going up to 1400? I mean, you've got Norman and you've got Norman descendants that are actually on the throne, and yet you've got Glendower that's making these treaties with the French. So it really shows that France wasn't united at that time, or as united as it is now, or even as united as it was under Charlemagne, I guess, because you would have had certain French that supported the Normans, and then you've got other parts of France which are supporting the Welsh. By 1405, most French forces had withdrawn after politics in Paris shifted towards peace, with the Hundreds' War continuing between England and France. On the 31st of March 1406, Glendower wrote a letter to be sent to Charles VI, the King of France, during a synod at the Welsh Church at Pennell, hence its name. Glendower's letter requested maintained military support from the French to fend off the English in Wales. Glendower suggested that in return he would recognise Benedict XIII of Avignon as the Pope. The letter sets out the ambitions of Glendower of an independent Wales with its own parliament, led by himself as Prince of Wales. These ambitions also included the return of the traditional law of Gweldar rather than the enforced English law, establishment of an independent Welsh church, as well as two universities, one in South Wales and one in North Wales. Following this letter, senior churchmen and important members of society flocked to Glendower's banner, and English resistance was reduced to a few isolated castles, walled towns, and fortified manor houses. So this shows you how important the Pope was to things. And if he would recognise Benedict XIII of Avignon as the Pope, then that would be lending support for this faction within the Roman Catholics as well, that obviously wanted to be in charge of things. And the Pope did have a lot of influence throughout all of these different countries. I mean, that was one of the main reasons why we split from the Roman Catholic Church, was that we thought that the Pope had too much say in the politics within Britain and within other countries as well. Any thoughts on that, Max?
A lot of this is quite new to me, actually, or very new to me, and so I'm just taking in, you know, what I'm learning through listening to you today. So I don't necessarily have any pre-constructed comments to make on some of these points.
It's all fairly new to me as well. Obviously, I live in Wales, and I don't think I've really heard of Owain Glendower until I actually came into Wales. And I've been to Machynlleth, which was supposed to be, you know, the central part where they had a museum and all the rest of it, and there really wasn't very much there, which is a great shame. And there's a statue of him that's in North Wales. I mean, he's a great nationalist hero, basically, to the Welsh. This letter is currently held in the Archives Nationale in Paris. Facsimile copies involving specialist aging techniques and moulds of the famous Glendower seal were created by the National Library of Wales, which were presented by the then Heritage Minister Alan Fred Jones to 6 Welsh institutions in 2009. The Royal Great Seal from 1404 was given to Charles IV of France and contains images and Glendower's title in Latin, Owenus de Gratia Princeps Waliae, Owain, by the grace of God, Prince of Wales. So he even had his own seal at the time. During early 1405, the Welsh forces, who had until then won several easy victories, suffered a series of defeats. English forces landed in Anglesey from Ireland and would over time push the Welsh back until the resistance in Anglesey formally ended towards the end of 1406. And Anglesey is in north of Wales. Following the intervention of French forces, battling ensued for years, and in 1406, Prince Henry restored fines and redemption for Welsh soldiers to choose their own fate. Prisoners were taken after battle, and castles were restored to their original owners. This year, a son of Glyndŵr dies in battle. By 1408, Glyndŵr had taken refuge in the north of Wales, having lost his ally from Northumberland. And then on the 21st of December 1411, the King of England issues pardons to all the Welsh, except for their leader and a Thomas of Trumpington, until 9th of April 1413, from which Glyndŵr was no longer accepted. However, this same year, his family were taken hostage by the king, and Glyndŵr died in relative obscurity years later, in maybe 1415 or 1416. So we jumped ahead a little bit there. At the same time, the English changed their strategy. Rather than focusing on punitive expeditions, as favoured by his father, the young Prince Henry adopted a strategy of economic blockades. Using the castles that remained in English control, he gradually began to retake Wales whilst cutting off trade and the supply of weapons. By 1407, this strategy was beginning to bear fruit, even though by this time Owain's rebel soldiers had achieved victories over the king's men as far as Birmingham, where the English were in retreat. In the autumn, Owain's Aberystwyth castle surrendered while he was away fighting, and in 1409 it was the turn of Harlech Castle. Edmund Mortimer died in the final battle, and Owain's wife Margaret, along with two of his daughters and three of Mortimer's granddaughters, were imprisoned in the Tower of London, and they were all to die in the Tower in 1413 and were buried at St. Swithin, London Stone. So the king has issued all these pardons to the Welsh, and yet they still won't turn Glyndŵr in. They remained loyal to him right to the end. Glyndŵr remained free, but he had lost his ancestral home, and he was a hunted prince. He continued the rebellion, particularly wanting to avenge his wife, and in 1410, after a suicide raid into rebel-controlled Shropshire, which took many English lives, some of the leading rebels that were supporting him are thought to have been captured. In 1412, Owain led one of the final successful raiding parties with his most faithful soldiers, and cut through the king's men, and in an ambush in Brecon, he captured and later ransomed a leading Welsh supporter of King Henry's, Dafydd Gam, English for Crooked David. So there were traitors amongst him, but none of them actually ended up selling him out. But there were traitors that were supporting the English by this time. This was the last time that Owain was seen alive by his enemies, although it was claimed he took refuge with the Scudamore family. As late as 1414, there were rumours that the Herefordshire-based Lollard leader, Sir John Oldcastle, was communicating with Owain, and reinforcements were sent to the major castles in the north and the south. But by then, things were changing. Henry IV died in 1413, and his son, King Henry V, began to adopt a more conciliatory attitude to the Welsh. Royal pardons were offered to the major leaders of the revolt and other opponents of his father's regime. Nothing certain is known of Owain Glyndŵr after 1412. Despite enormous rewards being offered, he was neither captured nor betrayed. He ignored all the royal pardons. Tradition has it that he died and was buried possibly in the church of Saints Mal and Sullian at Corwen, close to his home, or possibly on his estate in Sycharth, or on the estates of his daughter's husband Kentchurch in southern Herefordshire, or Monnington in West Herefordshire. In his book The Mystery of Jack Kent and the Fate of Owain Glyndŵr, Alex Gibbon argues that the folk hero Jack of Kent, also known as Sion Kent, the family chaplain of the Scudamore family, was in fact Owain Glyndŵr himself. Gibbon points out a number of similarities between Sion Kent and Glyndŵr, including physical appearance, age, education and character, and claims that Owain spent his last years living with his daughter Alice, passing himself off as an aged Franciscan friar and family tutor. And there are many folk tales of Glyndŵr donning disguises, to gain an advantage over his opponents during the rebellion. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, it's just that it was a time of great turmoil, and you know, as we said, because there were so many rival noble families who could have who could have provided a monarch, that in order for somebody to actually become king and to sustain themselves as king, they had to build alliances amongst these families. And although they were able to build these alliances, the alliances weren't necessarily permanent things, and there was a certain amount of shifting sand with people switching sides, and sadly for Owen Glyndwr, he eventually lost everything, really, because you mentioned about losing his castle and his lands, but he also lost his family as well. His wife was held by Henry IV, I think it was, and died, and so it was quite a sad end for him, really.
He should have pressed on when he had the advantage, you know, when the Welsh army were facing off against the English army, and after 8 days, and then the Welsh army backed down. I think they really should have pressed on with their advantage. Adam of Usk, a one-time supporter of Glyndwr, made the following entry in his chronicle under the year 1415. After 4 years in hiding from the king and the realm, Owain Glyndwr died and was buried by his followers in the darkness of night. His grave was discovered by his enemies, however, so he had to be reburied, although it is impossible to discover where he was laid. Thomas Pennant writes that Glyndwr died on the 20th of September, 1415, at the age of 61, which would place his birth at approximately 1354. In 1875, the Reverend Francis Kilvert wrote in his diary that he saw the grave of Owain Glyndwr in the churchyard at Monnington, hard by the church porch and on the western side of it. It is a flat stone of whitish grey, shaped like a rude obelisk figure, sunk deep into the ground in the middle of an oblong patch of earth from which the turf has been pared away and, alas, smashed into several fragments. In 2006, Adrian Jones, the president of the Owain Glyndwr Society, said, 4 years ago, we visited a direct descendant of Glyndwr, a John Skidmore, at Kentchurch Court near Abergavenny. He took us to Mornington Straddle in Herefordshire, where one of Glyndwr's daughters, Alice, lived. Mr. Skidmore told us that he, Glyndwr, spent his last days there and eventually died there. It was a family secret for 600 years, and even Mr. Skidmore's mother, who died shortly before we visited, refused to reveal the secret. There is even a mound where he is believed to be buried at Mornington Straddle. So that would fit in with the other story that said that he went there to live with his daughter. Renowned historian Gruffydd Aled Williams suggests in a 2017 monograph that the burial site is in the Kimbolton Chapel near Leominster, the present parish church of St. James the Great, which used to be the chapelry of Leominster Priory, based upon a number of manuscripts held in the National Archives. Although Kimbolton is an unexceptional and relatively unknown place outside of Herefordshire, it is closely connected to the Scudamore family. Given the existence of other links with Herefordshire, its place within the mystery of Owain Glyndwr's last days cannot be discounted. As of 2015, his final resting place remains uncertain. After his death, Glyndwr acquired mythical status as the hero awaiting a call to return and liberate his people. Thomas Pennant, in his tours in Wales, 1778, 81 and 83, searched out and published many of the legends and places that were associated with the memory of Glyndwr. In the late 19th century, the Cymru Fedd, or the Young Wales Movement, recreated Glyndwr as the father of Welsh nationalism. The creation of the National Assembly for Wales brought him back into the spotlight, and in 2000, celebrations were held all over Wales to commemorate the 600th anniversary of Glyndwr's revolt, including a historic reenactment at the Millennium National Eisteddfod of Wales in Llanelli 2000. Glyndwr is now remembered as a national hero, and numerous small groups have adopted his symbolism to advocate independence or nationalism for Wales. For example, during the 1980s, a group calling themselves Mebion Glyndwr claimed responsibility for the burning of English holiday homes in Wales. Glyndwr came second to Aneurin Bevan in the 100 Welsh Heroes poll of 2003. Stamps were issued with his likeness in 1974 and 2008. And streets, parks and public squares were named after him throughout Wales. There is a campaign to make the 16th of September, the date Glyndwr raised his standard, a public holiday in Wales, including by Dafydd Gwigley in 2021. And many schools and organisations commemorate the day and street parades, such as the Gwyl y Fflam, the Festival of the Flame, which are held to celebrate it. And interestingly, it was the 16th of September when the new King Charles actually came to the Welsh Senedd. And it was mentioned that this was actually, you know, Owain Glyndwr Day, that the English king came and spoke to the Welsh government there. And Owain Glyndwr as well, he had a reputation for stealing from the rich and handing it out to the poor. So he was a real life Robin Hood, and that was one of the reasons why so many people flocked to his standard and supported him. I mean, there's a lot of background to this. There's a lot of myth around him as well, which likens him to King Arthur, which was another famous Welsh son that is supposed to come back to liberate his people, is supposed to just be sleeping. So you have a lot of folklore that actually surrounds this character as well. And he's a great nationalist hero of the Welsh. He's looked to as the first Welsh nationalist. Max, any thoughts on Owain Glyndwr?
As I said earlier on, I think he can be celebrated as a man of his type, a man who was of noble birth, a man who had aspirations to be king, and who had the courage to act out his desires and to attempt to achieve that greatness. I think from the point of view of a modern perspective on Owain Glyndwr, it's a shame that so many men of that type had to fight against each other. And the fact that Welsh nationalists who desire the fragmentation of the United Kingdom lionize Owain Glyndwr to the extent that they do, and use his name in order to, as I say, try and fragment the United Kingdom, because my personal feeling is that the British Isles should be the United Kingdom, and in that I include Southern Ireland as well, because I've visited Southern Ireland on a number of occasions. I don't regard the people there as foreign in any respect. I've visited Northern Ireland on many occasions. I don't regard the people that live there as foreign in any respect, and I think that the United Kingdom would be so much stronger if we were if the whole of the British Isles were united under one leadership. And as I said earlier on, it's just a shame that men of Owain Glyndwr's calibre and ambition and vision are very few and far between and difficult to find nowadays.
Well, yeah, and like the memory of him was hijacked, really, because as you pointed out, he was supportive of the being part of the United Kingdom. I mean, that was what this tripartite indenture was about. It was about the three of them ruling over Britain, and he'd already served under the English king, and so he'd already showed that he was loyal to him. One of the things that amazes me is, at this time they didn't have newspapers, they didn't have the internet, and yet the word got out and all the students left Oxford and Cambridge to make their way to Wales. So just word of mouth was able to get the news out there that, a new hero had arisen and taken on the role of the Prince of Wales and was fighting for his independence. And somehow, all these Welsh supporters were able to make their way back to Wales and hook up with him and find out where the army was to help him. And all of it was just done by word of mouth. I mean, it just seems quite amazing to me in a time when we didn't have televisions, newspapers, the internet, and that's a long way to travel as well. And yet that's what happened.
There would have been hundreds, though, of town criers. It's a job that nobody does nowadays, other than for sort of obscure ceremonial purposes. But I'm pretty sure that each market town would have had a town crier, and the town criers would have had like a circuit, so they would have travelled around perhaps seven towns in 7 days and just continue to go round and round in that same circle of seven towns, picking up the news from the other town criers that they bumped into from time to time, and just passing that information on to within the circle of towns that they served. And so word of mouth in that way can spread pretty quickly.
Yeah, I guess they would have had a postal system as well, or some variation of the postal system. Yeah, it's quite incredible that it managed to hold off the English for all that time as well, and to make all these alliances that he did with the French and the Bretons and the Scottish. And it's just a great shame that he didn't succeed, really. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more in our series of presentations on our greatest Britons here at Radio Albion in the future.